The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, 40 Under 40, the 2018 Class. And the article actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with separate articles for each person that's profiled. The first one is Randy Allen, 32 years old, Senior Project Manager, Behringer Construction. And there's also a box with a closer look. It says company description, general contractor and commercial construction, birthplace Durham, family members, wife Nikki, parents Kirby and Debbie, brother Rick, education, BS, civil engineering, NC State University. What accomplishments are you most proud of? I'm lucky to have been involved in the construction of a variety of challenging projects for clients, including Apple, Bank of America, Cisco, Red Hat, and the NC State University Nonwovens Institute. Helping clients realize a vision and delivering projects that make a positive impact on their business is rewarding. Early in my career, I was also part of the teams that built the Raleigh Marriott and City Plaza projects in downtown Raleigh that opened up the south end of Fayetteville Street. Being part of the revitalization of Raleigh is exciting, especially seeing all of the continued growth downtown. What community causes or charities have you been involved in during the past year? Interfaith Food Shuttle, Raleigh-Wake Partnership to End and Prevent Homelessness, Wake Technical Community College Engineering Competition, Volunteer Judge. What is the greatest obstacle you have overcome in your career? My youth, and especially my youthful appearance. One of the first impressions people have when they meet me is how young I look, and it's been that way my entire career. In our business, clients often trust myself and my team with projects that can have severe consequences for their company if things don't go as planned. It can be tough to gain someone's trust when they immediately perceive you as too young to do the job. However, I've been blessed to work for companies that have never been afraid to give me as much responsibility as I can handle and let my performance speak for me. Nothing makes me madder than when the people at Bojangles drive-thru don't put enough seasoning on the fries. What is your favorite Triangle restaurant? Gonza, tacos, and tequila. Who would make the guest list for your dream business lunch? Warren Buffett, Dan Cathy, CEO of Chick-fil-A, Rick Astley, and Mark Cuban. What is your secret talent? Still getting student discounts with my old college ID. And we'll read one more. The next one is Antoine Arnold, 35 years old, executive director of AMI Kids Infinity, Wake County. Closer look. Company description. Help children discover the potential within them to transform their lives and strengthen our community. Birthplace. Shaw Air Force Base, Sumter, South Carolina. Family members. Mother Jacqueline. Father Ronnie. Wife Ebony. Daughter Aubrey. Sister Tori. Brother Eric. Education. BA, University of South Carolina Upstate. Management Information Systems. MS, Capella University, Human Behavior. What accomplishments are you most proud of? Marrying my beautiful wife and creating my princess, Aubrey Elizabeth Arnold. What community causes or charities have you been involved in during the past year? Child hunger and breast cancer awareness. What is the greatest obstacle you have overcome in your career? Stepping up to the plate to lead as executive director for Infinity Wake County. Nothing makes me madder than seeing Clemson win in any sport. Gamecock Nation, rise up. What is your favorite Triangle restaurant? The Pit. Who would make the guest list for your dream business lunch? Jay-Z, Bill Gates, Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan, Tyler Perry, Ebony Arnold, Aubrey Arnold. And what is your secret talent? Drawing. And we'll read more of those if there's time at the end. But for now, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Wilmington's explosive growth expanding to nearby counties. One of North Carolina's hottest real estate markets continues to be, surprise, Pender County. The county, located just north of Wilmington, includes Topsail Beach and Surf City, Data from the North Carolina Regional Multiple Listing Services, as gathered by Coldwell Banker Seacoast Advantage, showed Pender County had a 32% increase in home sales from May 2017 to May 2018, and the median price in the county rose 3% to $266,500. Audie Barefoot, president and CEO of Raleigh's Fonville Morrissey Barefoot, is involved in projects in the region and says the explosive growth in Wilmington has pushed developers to look to nearby counties for opportunities. In New Hanover, there's not much left to develop, so it's going up Highway 17 to Hampstead to Scott Hills, he says. There's a lot going on. It's going to Brunswick or going to Pender. Brunswick County, which includes Bald Head Island, saw home sales rise 18% from May 2017 to May 2018. Onslow County, with a heavy military presence, saw a 14% rise in sales. New Hanover, which includes Wilmington as well as Carolina Beach and Cure Beach, is growing as well. That county saw a 9% increase. Former NFL coach Cowher has Raleigh home on the market. Biz says best wishes to Bill Cowher, who retired from coaching the Pittsburgh Steelers, to become a CBS analyst and settle in Raleigh with his family. Cowher was a star linebacker for NC State University when he met Kay Young, a Wolfpack basketball player, at Edwards Grocery on Hillsborough Street. Cowher got her number, but the next day couldn't remember if he had met Kay or her twin sister, Faye. So he called, gave his name, and brazenly asked, "Is A there?" speaking quickly to mask that he didn't know the first consonant. Kay came to the phone, and they were married in 1981 and had three children. He retired from the Steelers in 2007 and moved to Raleigh. But Kay Cowher died of cancer in 2010. He has since married Veronica Stiegler and shifted his time to New York. As for the 6,480-square-foot house, Cowher has dropped the price from $2.39 million to under $2 million. With Cannons gone, new tenant coming in Wendell. A storefront in downtown Wendell has been home to the same clothing shop for more than a century. That business, Cannons Clothing, is now gone, but Biz has learned that the new party rental store moving into the space in early fall plans to leave the building much as it is today. "We're not going to tear it down, we're going to keep it as it is," says new owner Sushil Narla. Narla and his wife Melody plan to fill the space with tables, chairs, and imported high-end linens that can be rented for parties and special events. "It was a showroom before, and I think it should continue being a high-end showroom," Narla says. The couple closed on the purchase of the building earlier in June, buying it from the third-generation owners of Cannons Clothing for $400,000. The family moved its women's store to Cameron Village in 2015, where the men's store had already relocated. The clothing store, founded by Isaac George Cannon in 1916, had operated out of 4,200 square feet across four storefronts at 10 North Main Street. The Narlas are calling their new business Southern Events and Social Affairs and plan to open September 1. Local companies team up on senior care in Raleigh. Ahead of its opening later this summer with 100 new jobs, Raleigh's Walton Wood Lake Boone Retirement Community has partnered with Cary Home Care Agency, Aware Senior Care. Once complete, Walton Wood Lake Boone will have 121 independent living apartments, 39 assisted living apartments, and 23 memory care apartments just off the Beltline. But with independent living, the first phase of the sprawling complex set to open, Walton Wood saw a need for more services for residents. Aware Senior Care will help with medication reminders, home maintenance, and mobility. Courage soccer player gets national exposure. The latest ESPN body issue includes a photo shoot done right here in the Triangle. The subject is former UNC Chapel Hill women's soccer standout and current forward defender for the Carolina Courage, Crystal Dunn. And she has built up a pretty impressive resume already, even at 25 years old. She has been an NCAA champion, both ACC Offensive and Defensive Player of the Year, MVP of the National Women's Soccer League, and a FIFA Under-20 World Cup champion. Before joining the Carolina Courage, Dunn played for the Chelsea Ladies Football Club and the Washington Spirit. Here, how Red Hat CEO's pay compares to his employees. The ratio of CEO to employee pay at Raleigh's Red Hat is 1:25 to 1. That's according to Red Hat's proxy statement, which includes a comparison of CEO Jim Whitehurst's fiscal 2018 total compensation of nearly $13.6 million to that of a median employee, $108,668. Whitehurst earned $13.6 million in total compensation for 2018, a big uptick from $11.1 million in 2017. Nearly all executives achieved larger payouts in fiscal 2018. CFO Eric Shander, for example, secured a total compensation of $3.4 million compared to a prorated $1.3 million for 2017, his first year in the role. Paul Cormier, Executive Vice President and President of Products and Technologies, saw $6.7 million in total compensation compared to $6 million last year. Michael Cunningham, Executive Vice President and General Counsel, raked in $3.5 million compared to $3.2 million last year. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. May numbers show RDU is continuing to grow. Recently released figures out of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority show continued growth at the airport in May. A total of 586,622 passengers boarded planes at RDU in the month, bringing the year-to-date total to more than $2.4 million. Here's how the top five carriers fared in May, including their regional partners. The numbers are for the passengers in May 2018, and then the percentage change since May 2017. Delta, 180,722, a change of 15.3%. American Airlines, 136,655. That's a change of minus 0.7%. Southwest, 122,896, 7.8%. United Airlines, 70,564, 6.3% change. And Frontier Airlines, 37,169, a 157.8% change. New Raleigh startup led by veteran entrepreneurs. Rich Lee and Matt Berry, a pair of entrepreneurs with blockbuster exits under their belts, are determined to do it again. This time with new startup Pureport. They've got the cash to scale quickly. Lee started with just $375,000 for Raleigh's hosted solutions. A few years later, it became a $310 million exit when it sold. Berry tells a similar story with Digital Smiths, which sold to TiVo in 2014 for $135 million. Out of the gate, Pureport has a developed technology and a $10 million funder. It also has competition, as it's playing in a space long dominated by technology giants such as Juniper, Cisco, and Citrix. We're doing something completely different, Lee says, and we've learned a couple of things through a lot of battle scars. We think we're smarter now. The company has a 9,000-square-foot office in North Hills and could grow from 10 employees to 25 by the end of the year. Berry says the firm is looking for people who are going to push the envelope. Lee and Berry met a decade ago when Digital Smiths was a hosted customer. In January, Lee heard about Pennsylvania-based Nuvem Networks, where three developers had spent years writing a software-as-a-service offering to enable cloud connectivity. They had the technology and the drive, but not the capital. That's a problem Lee and Berry, with exit proceeds in the bank, could solve. The pair bought the company and brought both the technology and its three founding developers to Raleigh a month ago, eyeing an opportunity to create an entirely new entity. When you look at cloud and the adoption rate, it's created demand to have more efficient ways, faster ways to connect to the cloud, Berry says. The technology allows a company to connect, no lengthy implementation required. A typical connection to the cloud is done through a public port, and when customers are onboarded, they have to make physical changes to their infrastructure. Our technology allows them to do that completely virtually, Berry says. Instead of taking days or weeks to set up, it can work in minutes, he says, adding that customers can use the capacity they use and pay only for what they use. Xylem hiring immediately as it ramps up in Durham. Xylem subsidiary Sensus is hiring immediately for the 300-job expansion in Durham that the company announced June 26. That's according to Todd Boyle, Xylem's vice president of human resources. Shortly after the announcement, Boyle, who was also chief human resources officer at Sensus prior to its acquisition by Xylem in 2016, says the decision to pick Durham for the expansion came down to talent. Despite the fact that North Carolina offered more in incentives than its competition, $3.5 million from the Tar Heel State compared to $3 million offered by New York, according to NC Department of Commerce. Obviously, we have a strong history here in the Triangle and have hired a tremendous amount of strong talent, he says. It notes the company is looking for a mix of professionals from hardware and software engineers to supply chain managers and technical support engineers. The positions, according to the state, average nearly $95,000 in annual salaries, and the firm, whose lease on Sensus's current headquarters space in Raleigh runs out in early 2019, isn't wasting time in combining its operation at its current Durham campus. Austrian firm buying Xerium, 3 months after announcing a review of strategic alternatives, manufacturing firm Xerium Technologies of Youngsville says it's being acquired by Andritz AG for $13.50 per share. In an interview following the June 25 announcement, Chairman James Wilson calls the deal a good outcome and one of a number of options the company has analyzed in recent weeks. It's going to be a benefit to employees and customers because Xerium is now going to be backed by a global company with a strong balance sheet and deep ties to the paper and pulp industry, says Wilson, who is also a general partner at Karl Marx Management, which owns nearly 13%. The board knows of no plans to change the headquarters or management, he says. Andritz is an Austrian plant engineering group with more than 25,800 employees. Its business touches on multiple industries from metalworking and steel to pulp and paper, the sector that Xerium, which makes machine covering and roll papers for paper and packaging, already operates within. Xerium, with 2,850 employees, already has one site in Austria. The all-cash transaction is nearly a 146.8% premium to what Xerium shares sold for in March, when its executives announced they were exploring options. The deal requires shareholder approval, but Karl Marx Management and Winfield Capital, which own a combined 20% of Xerium, have already entered into a voting agreement with Andritz that supports the transaction. Contractor denies leaking Epic Games information. A former Epic Games contractor is defending himself against the video game maker's claims that he leaked spoiler information about upcoming Fortnite releases on Reddit. Thomas Hanna, the defendant in a federal lawsuit lobbed by Epic on May 7, denies many of the Carey Company's allegations in his 19-page response, filed June 21. He admits he worked on the popular game and signed a non-disclosure agreement, but he contends his access to secret information was limited, and much of what was later published on Reddit was obtained elsewhere. Hanna was never granted access to knowledge or information that was months or even several weeks ahead of a scheduled release, states his response, filed by attorney Andrea Winters Morelos of Morelos Law in Durham. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Jennifer Henderson's page on life sciences. Cineo subsidiary sues former employees. Inventive Health Consulting, now part of Syneos Health following Inc. Research's 2017 mega merger with Inventive Health, has filed a federal lawsuit against former employees citing trade secret misappropriation and other allegations. The complaint states that while still employed at Inventive, former managing director Alan French Jr. and a former employee of a top client co-founded in 2015 a competitor, Equitas Life Sciences. During this time, French also secretly transitioned client work from Inventive to Equitas and performed the work through Equitas, the complaint states, including work for two top clients worth several million dollars in revenue from 2013 to 2016. To cover his tracks and explain away corresponding declining revenues, French told his superiors at Inventive that the client's need for consulting services had simply diminished. The complaint also claims that in the first half of 2016, the bulk of French's team members resigned, and none told Inventive that they planned to go work with French at Equitas. That is, however, precisely what happened. The former employees left Inventive to work for Equitas and secretly transitioned two of Inventive's top clients to Equitas, the complaint states. It adds that just 2 days before his resignation, French accessed myriad confidential documents using his Inventive computer and inserted a thumb drive into the computer immediately afterwards, presumably so that he could take and use Inventive's confidential information. French said in an email, "It is Equitas's policy not to comment on pending litigation." Syneos also declined to comment. Partnerships create new focus for Triangle CROs. Raleigh-based Syneos Health, with a new partnership with a Texas firm, is the latest contract research organization to stay heavy on research and data recently. It's part of a push for differentiation and greater efficiency in a maturing CRO industry. Syneos' partnership with Eligo Health Research of Austin is designed to accelerate finding and enlisting patients in clinical trials through Eligos, or Eligos, spelled E-L-L-I-G-O, Eligo's electronic health records-focused research platform. Access to more patients means drugs get to market faster, says Claire Grace, Vice President of Site and Patient Access with Syneos. Many CROs are looking at how we can move and transition from where we are to new models of clinical research. In January, Datavant, a Roivant-backed healthcare technology company formed late last year, landed its first academic partner in Duke Clinical Research Institute. Since Datavant's launch, on the heels of Roivant landing a $1.1 billion equity investment led by SoftBank Vision Fund, the company has integrated about 150 datasets. Those datasets are aimed at using artificial intelligence to improve the time and success of clinical trials as well as their costs. And that partnership was closely preceded by even more deals. Last year, Syneos debuted after the mega merger of Inc. Research of Raleigh and Inventive Health of Boston. Data and analytics have been areas of investment for fellow CROs recently, including Quintiles, which merged with IMS Health in 2016. PRA Health Sciences of Raleigh struck a partnership last year with California's Care Innovations. The deal was signed to enable PRA to virtually connect with clinical trial patients outside of clinical settings in their homes, according to the companies. Syntract looks for competitive edge. With four new centers of development established this year, San Diego and Research Triangle Park-based contract research organization Syntract is ready to execute on its competitive advantage. Chief Commercial Officer Jack Shannon says the company wanted to use data to understand what we're really good at and then develop a structure that could facilitate that and enhance continued growth in those areas. Syntract's new centers of development are focused on oncology, neurodegenerative diseases, rare and orphan diseases, and pediatric studies. "We've already seen growth in these areas," Shannon says. He adds, "We're always going to be on the lookout. Should we add another center of development, and what should that be?" Syntract employs about 800 people, with about 100 of those in the Triangle. Celgene sues Pharma with Durham operations. A New Jersey company has filed a patent infringement lawsuit against Synthon over generic versions of its multiple myeloma drug products. While patent infringement suits against generic companies are common, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has made recent statements about encouraging competition through timely market entry of generics. Celgene's lawsuit in federal court names Synthon Pharmaceuticals, Synthon BV, Synthon CRO, and Alvogen Pine Brook as defendants in the case. Synthon is a global company, and Synthon Pharmaceuticals' principal place of business is cited as Durham. According to Celgene's complaint, the action for patent infringement arises from the filing of a new drug application with the FDA seeking approval to commercially market generic versions of Celgene's Pomalyst drug products prior to the expiration of certain patents owned by Celgene. Commercialization is next, with Lucerno study done. Morrisville's Lucerno Dynamics has completed a study of its LoRa system device aimed at determining when and how PET or CAT scan injections go awry. Now the company is focusing on commercialization and becoming the standard of care. CEO Ron Latane says, when patients have PET CAT scans, they're injected with radioactive materials designed to accumulate at potential problem areas in the body, allowing them to be seen in images produced by the scans. But there are varying factors that may prevent the materials from reaching problem areas, called infiltrations, which may cause inaccurate images. The LoRa system aims to reduce infiltrations, monitoring when infiltrations occur and what factors may be contributing, for instance, a patient's body mass index or particular type of needle used. And now we turn to reporter Ben Graham's page on real estate. His first headline, co-working explodes in the Triangle. It's difficult to tell exactly where you are when you step into the new Spaces co-working compound on the ninth floor of the Dillon Tower in downtown Raleigh. The coffee bar and booths with floor-to-ceiling views over Glenwood South suggest a cafe. But across the room, glass walls box in offices that line the building's northern facade. Upstairs, more offices are interspersed with shared areas of low-slung tables and chairs. The two-story, 35,000-square-foot space marks the company's first significant foray into the Triangle amid rapid growth in co-working space. The concept is aimed at attracting startups, young tech workers, and other companies interested in flexible office with lots of amenities. Even larger outfits are using co-working spaces to test new markets. People want to come into a market, understand what their potential is, and be able to accommodate some immediate growth without committing to a lease, says Molly Glasgow, a vice president with JLL. The biggest names in the business are showing confidence in the Triangle. Spaces, a company owned by Regis, plans to open soon in buildings from Cary to Chapel Hill, including a lease it's poised to sign at the new 555 Mangum office tower being built in downtown Durham by Northwood Raven, according to multiple sources. The company also is eyeing space at the Crabtree Terrace building proposed next to Crabtree Valley Mall. In Durham, WeWork has already found tenants for its 58,000-square-foot space at the 27-story One City Center, despite ongoing construction, according to Greg Hills, managing partner at Austin Lawrence Partners, the firm developing the project. In the last 2 years, co-working space has accounted for nearly 400,000 square feet of leasing activity in the Triangle, much of that from WeWork and Spaces, according to JLL. A big chunk of that activity can be seen from the Dillon. In Glenwood South, workers are building One Glenwood Tower, which will have 81,000 square feet for WeWork. Spaces area manager Michelle Benson brushes off concerns about the new competition. There's enough for everybody, Benson says. She wouldn't reveal the percentage of spaces currently leased out, but expects to be occupied by August. The space has 300 workstations. John Camerata, co-founder and chief technology officer of startup InsureLife, set up shop in an office June 25. For Camerata, the concept gives his digital insurance business the amenities it needs, and he doesn't have to worry about office infrastructure. Those are distractions to us at this point, he says. IKEA loss means impairment charge for Cary Mall. In the wake of IKEA's departure from Cary Town Center, the mall's owner is having to reevaluate a loan secured by the mall, according to public filings from the company. CBL & Associates Properties has a $46.7 million loan tied to the mall, which it restructured in 2016 when IKEA emerged as a future tenant. But under the terms of the deal, the loan was set to mature if the contract with IKEA was terminated. When IKEA announced in May that it was abandoning its plans to open a store at Cary Town Center, CBL approached its lender about restructuring the loan, according to recent company filings. Loan documents filed with Wake County show the lender to be Prudential Insurance Company of America. The two couldn't come to an agreement, and now CBL is classifying the loan as impaired, meaning it's probable that not all of the principal and interest payments will be collected. Based on the results of these conversations between Prudential and CBL, the company concluded on June 4, 2018, that an impairment is required because it is unlikely that the company will be able to recover the assets net carrying value of $87.4 million through future cash flows, according to CBL's filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The situation isn't necessarily normal behavior for companies of this size, says Byron St. Singh, a partner with the Smith Debnam law firm. That doesn't mean the property is headed for foreclosure. The company could still work out a deal with the lender or find another avenue for financing, St. Singh says. When reached for comment, a CBL representative said the troubles with the loan have not changed the company's plans. After IKEA's departure, CBL officials said they still plan to redevelop the mall as a multi-use development with retail space, apartments, restaurants, and offices. Another office portfolio sale eclipses $30 million. A real estate investment firm has closed on a deal for a seven-building office portfolio in the Triangle worth $30.6 million, making it the second office sale in as many weeks to eclipse the $30 million mark. The acquisition totals more than 220,000 square feet and includes buildings spread throughout the Triangle, from North Raleigh to Research Triangle Park to Chapel Hill. The buyer, Real Op Investments of Greenville, South Carolina, is planning improvements to all the properties and is looking to expand its Triangle footprint. "We have some stuff in the pipeline, but nothing to the closing table right now," Real Op Vice President of Acquisitions Julian Nexon says. Prior to this deal, the firm's only asset in the region was a 67,000-square-foot office building on Crossdale Road in Durham. Command Center decision pushed back until July. Top brass from the U.S. Army visited the Triangle on June 20 in their search for a new command center that would be staffed by as many as 500 civilian and uniform employees, according to an Army spokesman. The visit by Army Undersecretary Ryan McCarthy and Lieutenant General Eric Wesley was part of the final stages of the search process. Army officials had previously planned to make a decision by the end of June, picking a location for the new command center from five metro areas named as finalists, including Raleigh. But that decision has been put off until July, says Patrick Sieber, Public Affairs Chief of Army Futures Command Task Force. He attributed the delay to the strength of the five metros under consideration. Those cities are Raleigh, Austin, Texas, Boston, Minneapolis, and Philadelphia, according to multiple reports. And now we turn to On Restaurants and Retail, written by Dathan Kazuk. Beer fans rejoice as Hardywood lands in the Triangle. The Richmond, Virginia brewery that's known for its popular gingerbread stout, or GBS as it's known in the beer community, will soon be distributing in the Triangle. Hardywood Park Craft Brewery has teamed up with Mims Distributing Company to bring its beer to this market. The move comes on the heels of Hardywood's latest $28 million West Creek Brewing facility just outside Richmond. The brewery, which first launched in 2011, is hitting the southeast and is starting to distribute into Atlanta. "We've long dreamed of distributing our beer in North Carolina," says Eric McKay, Hardywood president and co-founder. "With the might of our new West Creek Brewery and with such a powerful partner in Mims, the time was right to make our dream a reality." In the past, the brewery was limited by bandwidth, but just opened a new production facility on the northwest side of Richmond. The brewery will begin its rollout in the Triangle soon. To start, a limited number of beers will be released to a handful of retail shops in the area, such as the Glass Jug Beer Lab in Durham and Wine and Beer 101 in Wake Forest. Fans of the brewery often make trips to Richmond for the variants of GBS, which include a rum, rye, apple brandy, and whiskey barrel releases, as well as the popular Kentucky Christmas Morning Stout. Over time, shops in the Triangle will receive Hardywood's flagships, Virginia Root Series and the Barrel Series, as well as a handful of small batch beers. "Mims Distributing has been soliciting Hardywood for 5 years. We have been patient and are ecstatic to be able to represent Hardywood with their world-class beer," said Jeff Mims, Chief Sales Officer at Mims. Chris Creech, who runs the Glass Jug Beer Lab, is thrilled to have one of the pioneers of Richmond's exploding beer scene here in the Triangle. "We've watched their growth from across the state line for many years, and we could not be more excited that they're finally going to be on North Carolina shelves on a regular basis," he says. Creech is especially excited to carry the brand's GBS. Gingerbread Stout has a cult following, and we're looking forward to bringing that beer to our customers later this year, he says. Hardywood is now being distributed throughout Virginia, eastern Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C., and as well in limited markets in the United Kingdom. North Carolina chefs show skills in statewide event. More than 50 chefs from across North Carolina are competing in the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association's inaugural Chef Showdown, and the regional competition was held in Raleigh on June 25. Each of the 10 chefs who competed at Vigrio on Glenwood South were scored by three judges, Tim Parrish, the NC Department of Agriculture, Matthew Krenz, NCRLA's 2017 Chef of the Year and Executive Chef at Charlotte's The Asbury at the Dunhill Hotel, and Lisa Prince, host of Flavor NC, a television program. The chefs are battling to be in the final 21 who will compete at Aria Tuscan Grill at Founders Hall in Charlotte on August 27. The winners will be crowned NCRLA Chef of the Year and NCRLA Pastry Chef of the Year. Some of the locals involved include Scott Shabbat, Wahlburgers Raleigh, Thomas Card, Counting House at 21C Museum Hotel Durham, Teddy Diggs, previously of Il Palio Chapel Hill, and Nicole Laurie, Counting House at 21C Museum Hotel Durham. The three judges sat alone at a table at Vigrio as every half hour, another dish and chef made their way out to discuss their dish. The winning chefs from the three regional showdowns will be announced July 9. Rose returning to Chapel Hill's Il Palio restaurant. Chapel Hill's Il Palio restaurant at the Siena Hotel has a familiar face coming back to take the helm. Executive Chef Adam Rose will return to the hotel to lead dining operations July 1. Rose was the executive chef at Il Palio from 2007 to 2013 when he left to become the executive chef and partner at Black House Restaurant in Durham from 2013 to 2015 when it closed. Prior to his first stint at Il Palio, Rose was the head chef at Elaine's on Franklin in Chapel Hill. A native of Long Island, New York, Rose began working in places such as Jack the Horse Tavern in Brooklyn before moving to North Carolina. Hotel General Manager Anthony Carey says, having Chef Adam walk back through the kitchen door of Il Palio restaurant was like a dream sequence from a movie. Guests can expect new offerings such as cooking classes and a dining experience with Rose, one of which will involve making sangria. Asheville Brewery brings new taproom to Durham. Asheville's Highwire Brewing plans to open a Durham taproom late this year. The brewery now has two locations in Asheville and will open its third taproom in Durham at 800 Taylor Street in the Golden Belt campus. The brewery plans to call it the Durham Fun Zone. The taproom will be 8,844 square feet of interior space and also will feature outdoor seating and a beer garden with an 1,678 additional square feet. The bar will feature 24 beers on tap, including year-rounds, seasonal, specialty, sours, and one-offs, as well as wine, local ciders, and guest taps. And finally, Durham Sushi Restaurant closes doors after 3 years. Echelon Experiences is closing Basan, its Durham sushi restaurant. The company says the three-year-old restaurant will remain open through June 30. It was our first Durham venture, and we loved having our own little piece of such a vibrant and growing city, says Dustin Slemp, Echelon's creative director. We will miss our Durham family and the guests that have stuck by us over the years. Those guests allowed us to bring our vision to life, and we thank them for it. Echelon will continue to manage its other four concepts in Durham and has no plans to replace Basan with another concept in the future. Echelon plans to offer staff members jobs at its other locations in Raleigh. The company did not disclose a reason for the closure. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Local Business, written by Ryan Haar. Durham Company creates buzz around Triangle. Durham-based B Downtown, spelled B-E-E, is attracting Fortune 500 companies in an unusual way. The company, founded by CEO Lee Catherine Bonner, is placing beehives on top of buildings across the Triangle. It's a highly marketable sustainability initiative, says Bonner, who started the company in 2014 when she was still a student at NC State University. The bees themselves are just one part of Bee Downtown's threefold product. Bee Downtown's beekeepers visit each hive every 2 weeks to maintain them and provide another part of the product, data. Health of the hive, how much honey they have, if there's any diseases. It's very science-based, and there's a lot of collection that goes into it, says Bonner. Some might wonder what a company such as SAS would use that data for, but according to Bonner, it's used in internal communications, marketing strategies, and sustainability reports. SAS was just named by Forbes as one of the best companies to work for, and a lot of that had to do with their sustainability initiatives, where our hives were heavily featured, says Bonner. The third part of Bee Downtown's objective is an employee engagement and leadership development function. Some campuses have used the hives as part of team-building initiatives, where Bee Downtown guides teams through the ins and outs of the hives and beekeeping. Our leadership program uses biomimicry, where you take inspiration from nature to solve real-world problems. Bees are a beautiful example of leadership and community, Bonner says. Several Triangle campuses are buzzing thanks to Bee Downtown, including American Tobacco Campus, NC State, and IBM. Bonner, whose company has 5 full-time employees and 1 part-timer, says pricing is customizable for each company depending on how many hives they want and how much of their employee engagement and leadership services they want to use. The company expanded to Atlanta this year and has placed hives at many major corporate headquarters there, including Delta, Chick-fil-A, UNESCO, and Intercontinental Exchange. It's wonderful how cities are coming together for sustainability. We're asking every company to play a small part in something so big, Bonner says. Wake County leading municipal growth in North Carolina. A new report from the UNC Chapel Hill Carolina Population Center reveals that the majority of the state's municipalities have experienced population decline, 0% growth, or stagnant growth since 2010, according to U.S. Census Bureau data. Only 125 municipalities are experiencing growth the same as or faster than the state. The majority of these expanding municipalities are in the Triangle, Charlotte, and Wilmington regions. Wake County had 6 municipalities in the top 10 when it came to overall percentage growth. Rollsville, 103%, Fuquay-Varina, 55%, Holly Springs, 43%, Morrisville, 42%, Wake Forest, 40%, and Knightdale, 39%. There were no surprises for us as to where we were ranking, says Sharon Peterson, Wake County Long Range Planning Administrator. One tool for projecting growth is looking at transportation projects. Peterson says the extension of I-540 will imply growth for Fuquay, Varina, and Garner. One of the major transportation impacts is coming from the extension of 540, so a lot of the growth from the west and the south has to do with 540. As it's extended east, we expect to see more growth in Fuquay, Varina, and Garner, she says. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, and we start with the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Survey Reflects Palpable Partisanship About Economy. If you want to know the economic sentiment of CEOs, wealthy investors, and folks running small businesses in the U.S., CNBC's latest Millionaire Survey, released June 27, offers some perspective as we enter the second half of 2018. CNBC used Spectrum Group to survey 750 people with more than $1 million in investable assets. Respondents had to be a financial decision maker or share jointly in financial decision making within the household. Among the major findings in the survey, 44% of respondents believe the economy will be stronger at the end of 2018. 66% of Republican millionaires believe the economy will be stronger at the end of the year, compared to only 19% of Democrats. Among the independents, the number is locked in at 40%. 42% of millionaires answered government dysfunction as the biggest risk to the U.S. economy in the next 12 months, the highest level in the past 4 years. National debt has risen to the second spot in terms of risk to the economy, followed by global unrest. Interestingly, the potential of a trade war was not mentioned because the survey may have been conducted before the latest tariff-related rhetoric from the U.S., China, and other European nations. There's little doubt from this survey that in political terms, people view the future state of the U.S. economy in sharp contrast. But to the CEOs and small business owners who recently benefited from the large corporate tax break, the timing of when the current 10-year streak of economic expansion will end is the pivotal unknown. Around the triangle, the plurality of decision makers believe it is a matter of when and not if as to when the expansion will end, and that sentiment is beginning the bake-in process for many employers. Already, companies such as Boeing, Lidl, IKEA, ClubCor, and many others are revisiting their robust expansion plans. They all offer different reasons, but it is hard to believe that their board members did not talk about the country's economic future when deciding on the pullback. In the coming months, look out for more failed mergers and acquisitions as companies try to anticipate and maneuver through this period of anticipated downturn. When the second quarter GDP numbers are released in the next few days, almost everyone expects a very strong showing. But the question is, how long can we keep this going? Because now we have gotten used to the good times. And also on the Viewpoint page, there's an article written by Michael Jacobs, who is the CEO of Jacobs Capital and a professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School. The headline, Really, how much is your company worth? One thing that executives of both public and private companies have in common is that neither has a very good understanding of what determines the value of their stock. When I headed corporate finance policy at the U.S. Treasury Department, I met with groups of Fortune 500 CEOs on numerous occasions, and they invariably complained about how Wall Street priced their stock. How can we announce a 20% growth in earnings and have our stock price fall? Easy. If the market expected 30% growth and had priced that into the stock, the earnings announcement told traders they had overestimated the company's expected cash flows, and the price declined accordingly. It is imperative for any executive, whether of a public or private company, to understand what determines the value of their business. The value of any business, simply put, is the sum of all expected future cash flows that will accrue to the owners, discounted to the present by a discount rate that reflects the time value of money and the risk of those cash flows materializing. Just because a company performs exactly as expected does not mean the stock value remains static. Every time assumptions change about the economy, interest rates, global peace, etc., that evolving worldview has implications for a company's ability to generate cash for its owners in the future. CEOs who complain that Wall Street only cares about short-term earnings are misguided. Please explain Tesla's stock valuation as a function of its quarterly earnings. Ditto for any growth company. For companies that are not growing rapidly, quarterly earnings are a reliable proxy for future cash flows, so they do matter. One advantage public company executives have is that on any given day, they can look up their stock price. Private company owners cannot, so they tend to focus on the wrong metric, one which is easily monitored, sales. This is very dangerous as revenues are often a poor proxy for cash flow, which is what dictates value. Private company owners frequently make false assumptions about how the pricing of a few deals in their industry translate into the value of their business. Not every company in a given sector sells for the same multiple of cash flow, which is commonly estimated by EBITDA. And when companies sell for a multiple of revenues, it is only because they have no cash flow and revenues are the best signal for future cash flows. I had the owner of a logistics company try to convince me the value of his company was equal to 1x its annual revenue because one of his competitors sold for that amount. His competitor owned sophisticated proprietary software used to schedule shipments for clients. It generated impressive margins. The owner I was speaking with had no proprietary software and produced much lower margins. Each dollar of revenue equated to much less cash for the owners, so the multiple should be materially different. In selling over 100 companies, I've witnessed countless business owners exhibit extreme confidence in their assessment of their company's worth, despite never having been through the process. Business valuation is far more nuanced than most people believe, but in some respects, it is also more straightforward. For example, when I explain how cash flow drives valuation, I invariably hear, what about my people, my reputation, my market position? If you have good people, a great reputation, and a defensible market position, all those will show up in the consistency and growth of your cash flows. If they do not, then you have misjudged their value. And now we turn to the small business section to read James Lee's column. James Lee is a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, Be Ready to Mitigate Conflict in Family Business. Every so often I hear from a reader who's thinking about going to work for a family-owned business. Usually the note or email from the non-family job candidate reads something like this. It's a great opportunity, but I've been told that I could be jumping into a snake pit because family businesses are full of conflict and backbiting. The money and the challenge are hard to turn down, so can you suggest how I can keep myself from being cut to ribbons? The generalization that family businesses are full of conflict is as meaningless as a statement like, chocolate chip cookies are burned on the bottom. There's potential for friction in a family company as there is in any organization where two or more human beings try to work or live together. In addition, of course, family companies can generate their own special brand of internal strife if less than loving family relationships, old hurts, or long-time biases are allowed to leak over into the work environment and taint business relationships. Actually, most family businesses either enjoy a strife-free atmosphere or have learned how to keep a lid on family members' personal stresses around the workplace. But a non-family executive manager or other employee can easily get into trouble by getting drawn into a family fracas. When tensions whose roots are outside of the business setting, i.e. Brother Bob's history of bullying behavior toward his siblings or Cousin Cleo's disdain for any job that requires arising before noon, suddenly show up in the offices and hallways, family members probably understand their origins and antidotes. The non-family member probably doesn't. Sister Susanna thinks, if Bob sticks out his chest at me one more time, I'll remind him of the baby in the bath pictures we can pass around at the next staff picnic. And she ignores Bob's posturing. Manager Mike, on the other hand, just moved over from a competitor's operations department. He thinks, I can't do my job if Bob's going to stomp around like a T-Rex with hemorrhoids. I don't know what's wrong with him, but if things don't improve, I'm out of here. Here are a few self-defense guidelines for non-family employees in a family-owned business. Carefully evaluate a family member's efforts to treat you just like one of the family. It could be a gesture of genuine friendship, but it could also be a recruiting drive prior to the opening of hostilities. Don't compete with a family member for the senior person's attention and favor. At the end of the day, blood is still thicker than water, and it's seldom that an outsider can displace even the least qualified child of the family. The fact that you tried won't soon be forgotten. Remember that many business founders hope that their companies will pass into the hands of their sons and daughters and keep the family name and achievements alive. That's a defining mark of family business. If those succession aspirations don't work out, you can offer to buy the business out of the family, but it's unlikely that you'll be counted as a successor candidate equal to the founder's offspring, so keep your expectations realistic. And watch for ways to enjoy working in the very special, if sometimes wacky, environment that's characteristic of most family businesses. With patience and a clear head, you can learn a lot and derive a great deal of satisfaction from being part of a great American enterprise. And now with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much of news from around the state as we can. Charlotte Tower sells for a record $222 million. This is written by Ashley Fahey. One of the newest office buildings to deliver in Charlotte's Central Business District has sold for a record-setting amount. 615 South College, developed by Atlanta-based Portman Holdings and delivered in the spring of 2017, was acquired by Los Angeles-based CBRE Global Investors for $222 million, according to Mecklenburg County Real Estate Records. The 18-story, 375,865-square-foot office building traded for about $590 per square foot, well above the previous per-square-foot record of $309 set by the sale of the Carillion Tower in 2016. Signed tenants at 615 South College include WeWork, BDO, Regions Bank, and Little Diversified Architectural Consulting. The tower was 84% leased at the time of the sale, according to CBRE. CBRE Global Investors has $104.2 billion in assets under management as of March, according to the company. It is an independently operated affiliate of CBRE Group. Tom Kirby, Senior Director of Commercial Operations at CBRE Global Investors, said, "Uptown's attractiveness, coupled with Charlotte's overall success story with two decades of unprecedented population growth, make this property a very exciting investment for our client. The office building is also the first new property to trade along Stonewall Street, where billions in real estate projects are planned or underway. The crane-ridden corridor has multiple developments under construction now, including two office towers, two hotels with a third planned, hundreds of apartments, and a Whole Foods market that opened last week. 615 South College was the first development to finish during the current wave of development along Stonewall. UNC Charlotte plans $84 million hotel conference center on campus. UNC Charlotte Chancellor Phil Dubois and representatives from the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority pitched City Council on June 25 for an $84 million hotel and conference center that would open at UNCC for the 2020 school year. The 4.4-acre site targeted for the project is located at the J.W. Clay Boulevard UNCC stop on the Blue Line Extension light rail line. It requires approval from the Zoning Commission, a process already begun by the university. Of the cost, a portion of existing tourism taxes would account for $8 million. Council would have to approve the Visitors Authority's funding for the hotel. A vote is anticipated August 27. All but $2 million of the remaining $76 million would come from the UNC Charlotte Foundation. Marriott would kick in $2 million. The hotel will be a 226-room Marriott with a 24,000-square-foot conference center and a 132-space parking deck. And now we turn to the Triangle Business Journal's Business Survey Pulse. The question, do you own or rent a home in the Triangle? The number of responses were 335. 78% say they own, while only 22% say they rent. And actually, we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.